Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Greetings, truth seekers, paradigm busters, new world order, civil disobedience, freedom fighters, free thinkers, higher mammals, good people of all types. How's it going? It is Michael Parker coming to you from my undisclosed lair somewhere in Los Angeles, California, West Coast, North America, third stone from the sun. It is Wednesday, December the 14th, as we edge closer and closer to Christmas. And I'm looking forward to Christmas. I'm going to be out of here for a few days. I'm going to go back to Texas and see my family. I'm looking forward to that. And I hope that whatever you and your family and friends are doing for the holidays, whichever one you celebrate, or maybe just take time off, whatever it is, I'm hoping that you're looking forward to some rest and relaxation. So a couple of news stories for us before we get into this. Dr. Stan Berry will be joining us in a little bit to talk about his work as a doctor and the early days of COVID and his new book called Full Disclosure. And in the second hour, Scott Powell will be here to talk with us about China, the WEF, talk about the U.S., a lot of different things. And John Matlin has got a couple of stories for us. And by now, you've probably heard that the Fed has announced that there's going to be another 0.5 basis points rise. That we all expected that. That's pretty much baked into the pie at this point. And I'm guessing that what you're going to see now is another 50 in January, February, and then maybe a 25 in March, because they're basically saying there's going to have to be at least 75 more basis points. So that's where we're at on that. Another news story is Grant Wall. And Peter Duke and I spoke about this yesterday. The U.S. soccer writer Grant Wall is now determined that he died of an aortic aneurysm. And that, according to the family and the people involved with the incident, they've determined that no amount of CPR of shocks would have saved him. So he died of a ruptured blood vessel. And you remember that Grant was a soccer journalist who was covering the World Cup last week. His wife, interestingly enough, Dr. Celine Gounder, was also kind of a bigwig in the Biden's administration combating COVID and all that. And she has been on the news talking about this. And, you know, I'm very sad for her and his family. And what's interesting about this is we were all wondering, okay, so what happened to Grant Wall? He had been complaining, well, not complaining, but stating that he was going through, you know, an illness, and he had gone to see a doctor. He had had a COVID test. He had tested negative. He went to see some doctors and they put him on antibiotics. They said that he probably had bronchitis. And, you know, he went back to covering the games. And then he died during that one match, and they could not revive him. The curious thing about this is we wonder, you know, what was this? Was it MERS? Was it a vaccination-related incident? What was it? Well, if you remember when we talked about Dr. Ryan Cole last week, he appeared on Dr. Drew's show, and Peter Duke and I talked about that interview. But one of the things that he said during that interview and has since been pointed out today by several people on Twitter is that Dr. Ryan Cole told Dr. Drew, this was his exact quote when he was talking about all this. He said, "The spike protein is literally causing the lymphocytes to chew a hole in the aorta. This is the biggest blood vessel in your body coming off of your heart. When that ruptures, you're gone in minutes." And this was an aortic aneurysm rupture. So I don't know. Was this related to that? I'm not a doctor. It's speculation, but I'm sure that you can do the math and figure this out. Now we'll have to wait and see what happened to this other photojournalist or cinematographer that also passed away. And then we find out that in January, another journalist had passed away. And I don't have that in front of me. Now, these could all be completely unrelated. Or maybe not. We'll have to wait and see. Hopefully they are unrelated and there's not something going on that we have to worry about, like, say, MERS or something like that. And I think that John Matlin's going to have some information on that in a minute. So we'll look forward to that. You guys, if you missed your favorite TNT radio show or interview, simply listen back when you want, wherever you want. Just visit episodes on the TNT Radio website. We are also on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and TuneIn. There is no reason to miss out on anything on TNT Radio.
Keeping you updated on the latest.
In the car while I'm driving home.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Many have not gotten their booster shots, and now the fear porn is back. What are you at risk for if you fail to get the booster shots? Also, is something more serious around the corner? Here to discuss this is TNT News producer John Matlin.
All right, forget the booster. No one's getting it at this point. Oh. We're not even going to talk about it. It's a very small amount. It's your choice. I mean, forget it, because we have to go back to square one, Michael. We're going to the original shot. With all of the stuff that's going on, there were some studies that are done. So if you haven't received your COVID vaccine, perhaps you should sound the alarms. We may not be allowed to correlate clots, myocarditis, strokes with the vaccine because trust the science, bro. However,
right,
if you are a science denier, you won't like this because the true science has come out and you should trust the science that promotes the shot. That's the only thing you should trust. And well,
that's
which science do you think I'm speaking of? Of course, the science that is emerging that you are more likely to be involved in a motor vehicle crash if you haven't had your COVID-19 vaccine.
Right.
I know. And that's why this is going to be quite sarcastic, this segment. So the data was based on traffic accidents in Ontario, Canada. A study published in the American Journal of Medicine shows researchers looking into crash correlation with vaccination against COVID-19. Correlation vaccination. I think they're trying to rhyme. So The theory and correlation is if someone neglects health recommendations, they may neglect basic rules of the road. This is groundbreaking science and use of resources. While we are ignoring endless amounts of people dropping dead in sudden fashion, we censor and ignore extremely disturbing data. But researchers and scientists are issuing reports of this nature, which may find you to be complicit in traffic accidents because you didn't get vaccinated, or it may also find you to think of this report as complete and absolute hogwash the way I do. So the final numbers say risk of crash were 50 to 70% higher for adults that are unvaccinated. But you can feel comfortable, allegedly, because researchers said they, quote, don't want unvaccinated people to feel persecuted, end quote. And they do not suggest that the unvaccinated stop driving, but is something more sinister on the horizon than a fender bender. Welcome to the new fear, the new world of fear, and welcome the new fear to the table. Camel flu. So in what I'm sure will be named a name change, as this will be deemed racist, as camels are found in the Middle East. So
right.
We can't get used to be calling it camel flu, but there will be a rename allegedly in the near future. And if I'm the one to have an opinion on it. So health officials are warning that doctors around the world should start looking for signs of camel flu as the soccer fans or football fans, if you will, depending on where you reside, start to return from the World Cup. The camel flu is better known as MERS. You have probably heard of it. So it can come from uncooked camel meat, unpasteurized camel milk, close contacts with camels, and of course, those that are infected that are human. So the word is that it's 35% of the times a fatal sickness. That's the cases. So the numbers to look at, 2.45 million people attended the first 48 matchups of the World Cup. And with Bill Gates, John Hopkins, and the WHO simulating another pandemic just days ago, the way they did just months before the COVID pandemic with the infamous event 201, one may wonder, are we headed to the second pandemic all the, quote, leaders, end quote, have warned us about in the matter of fact fashion? So I wouldn't be surprised, Michael. And I don't know if you're ready for your camel flu vaccine. Worst case scenario, you'll be a better driver on the streets of LA. And of course, you will eventually just possibly drop dead.
It gets more ridiculous every day. So first of all, on the camels, let me just say this. When I was in Egypt, I got to ride a camel for the first time in my life. And I had a photo taken of me standing up on a camel, which I really love, which maybe I will put on social media at some point. But I got a lot of love and respect for the camels. And I, like you, when I first heard this term camel virus, I'm like, well, wait a minute. You can't say that, because camel virus, isn't that like monkeypox? And somebody's going to get offended, so they're going to have to change that. And but all jokes aside, I did, because I spoke with Peter Duke about this whole camel virus thing yesterday, and he and George Webb were talking about all this over the weekend and the catastrophic contagion tabletop exercise and mayors being renamed as camel virus and all this. But today, just out of curiosity, I did a quick Google search. I did find an article from Science magazine back in 2013, and the title was New Middle Eastern Virus Found in Camels. It says researchers confirmed that camels are harboring the deadly MERS virus, but whether they are infecting humans remains unclear. Point being, just like with the bats and the pangolins and all these other things, even if these viruses reside in these animals, it really is highly unlikely that they transfer to humans. And when they do, as Dr. Andrew Huff said the other day, it's usually as the result of something that has had gain of function applied to it and advanced the evolution of that virus in ways far beyond it would happen in nature. So yeah, like you, I'm totally skeptical of this. It seems like more fear porn. And then when we get to the whole driving thing, well, come on, that is absolutely ridiculous. One of my favorite lines in this, they talk about this Dr. Donald A. Rendlemere, a University of Toronto medical professor and physician, said investigators, quote, theorized that adults who neglect health recommendations may also neglect basic road safety guidelines. Now, if that is not incontrovertible evidence of your possible driving mishap, I don't know what would be.
Yeah, to go back to the camel flu, we have to. I mean, personally, I never heard MERS referred to as the camel flu. I've only heard it referred to as MERS. So, what better way to package a new name on it if you were going to issue some form of fear porn or a new pandemic, where the perfect thing would be everyone showing up to the stadium and then dispersing it to their own countries. So this is just a very interesting. This is very interesting, Michael. They've given it a new name to roll it back out, and yeah, we're looking at something that I'm sure they can come up with an mRNA vaccination after a few tests on a couple of rodents. So where are we here? And then we talk about, you said how it was an aortic aneurysm that the journalist had. That is for somebody who used to do CAT scans, when we would have a positive aortic aneurysm, you would know, it's very obvious. If it's dissecting, which means it's starting to shred open, you know it's very obvious. There's a big black line that goes down your aorta. That's your main thing. It's kind of like when you're driving on a highway and that wheel starts to get a bubble. You know that once that bubble goes, the tire goes. So We're seeing if it's attacking vessels the way Dr. Cole is saying, and I would trust his words more than mine, as he's an actual doctor and I'm a CAT scan tech. You know, when you see these things occur on with your own eyes, it's very obvious, and it's not something that really genuinely happens often. So if people are of young ages are dying all the time of aneurysms, you're better off just saying it's the environment than talking about the facts at this point, because the other side doesn't want to listen to that.
John, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you, like, how frequently does this happen? And I was under the impression that an aortic aneurysm or rupture is usually related to, you know, genetics. And what else could cause that?
Genetics and age usually can be found more in older people. Have I seen younger people? I've personally watched someone in their 30s in excruciating pain come in, say they were dying. And, you know, usually the first thought is that this person's probably overreacting. But with the signs and symptoms, we brought them up to CAT scan. And yeah, once we saw what we saw, we were like, he is 100% right. He is dying, and he was dead within 5 minutes. Now, something like that is, again, an aortic aneurysm that dissects and starts to shred and pop. There is no real coming back from that. It's seconds. Right. So to repair it, it's got to be quick. And if you're catching it at the end, so you're saying what makes you predisposed? I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the history of that patient was excessive steroid use. So there's things that can change and mess with your body, obviously. And one may say, of course, this is an assumption, that if everyone is getting all these vaccinations for this hyper spike protein, right? And they go to this and they end up getting the camel flu, that might be your gain of function right there, because once you get it, your body's not going to fight it the way bodies are meant to fight it. And what happens if you start shedding it differently because you have a different thing in your genetics? I don't know. I'm just surmising, like the people that surmise that if you took the shot, you're safer on the road.
When I kept seeing people pass that around, I couldn't even read it because I was like, surely this is a joke. But in the back of my mind, and this is another thing I was talking to Peter about yesterday, it's like we are now in the stage of the downward spiral that when you look at something, you don't know if it's satire or real.
Yep. And I totally looked at that yesterday and I was like, oh, this has got to be a joke. I can't even look at it.
Yeah.
And then I saw it again today and I said, I'm going to dive in. And oh my God, it was real.
I'm glad you did. Well, John Matlin, I look forward to what we talk about in the second hour. Thank you for the report. This is TNT Deprogram, and we will be back in just minutes with Dr. Stan Berry.
Pavoy Morich on TNT Radio.
Three people have been killed, and at least two nuclear-capable bombers were likely damaged in separate blasts at two Russian airfields. Two Tu-95 long-range strategic nuclear bombers were damaged by a drone that fell on the runway at the Engels airfield in western Russia's Saratov region. So drone warfare, Skynet is becoming self-aware. I think more and more we're going to begin to see countries utilizing, testing, you know, kamikaze drones, drone swarms. We have drone Black Hawk helicopters now that don't need humans on board. All sorts of, you know, self-driving tanks and that sort of stuff. So it's only a matter of time, but it's war. That's the name of the game.
Pavoy Morich on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds. And they do it by the types of posts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis. By suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook
has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
And now a news update. The president's doctor has confirmed that the president is suffering from gastric distress. Apparently, he can't stop Putin.
You're stupid.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Holy cow, ladies and gentlemen. Truth Seekers, we are back. It is Deprogrammed here on TNT. And for the remainder of this hour, we have a new voice, a person that hasn't been on the show. I always love when we have fresh faces around here. And it is Dr. Stan Berry. He is a maternal fetal medicine physician who has provided care to women with high-risk pregnancies for 37 years. In April of 2020, he was featured in Time Magazine as part of the Heroes of the Front Lines. And he has a brand new book that is called... I believe it is Full Disclosure, A Fight for Full Disclosure. And that's what I want to talk to him about, because clearly the medical aspect of our society has been under a great deal of pressure the last several years. And I don't see that easing up anytime soon. Dr. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me for the interview.
Well, I'm glad that you're here. And when I was reading about you and going through these papers, and I was immediately drawn to this Time Magazine thing. So back in 2020, you were prepared to retire and start writing, but COVID comes around, you felt called to do this. And some of the people around you were trying to urge you not to do it.
Yes, that's true. And I want to say from the outset, as it turned out, I was a bit of a paper tiger. What happened was that the city of Detroit got hit tremendously hard by COVID. We had an astronomical death rate. We were a red zone. And we were, quite frankly, running out of positions in the city. And I, you know, by trade, I'm a glorified obstetrician, a maternal fetal medicine specialist. But I volunteered. I put my name on the list to be repurposed as an emergency room physician. And they didn't call me, so I called them back, and I was fully prepared to do it. But I wound up not being called to work in the emergency room, so instead I volunteered extra time in our obstetrical clinic in order to get people in and out of the clinic as quickly as possible. And you alluded to friends of mine. That's actually how the Time Magazine article came across, because a number of my friends and family urged me not to volunteer, but I, as you said, I felt called. And a friend of mine, unbeknownst to me, wrote a tribute on his Twitter page, and that was picked up by Time Magazine. So that's how it all happened.
Well, it's interesting you say that, you know, you offered up your services, you wanted to help, and they didn't end up calling on you to do so. This is not the first time that I've heard this. And it's just interesting to me because we were in such a bind at the time. Mm-hmm. You would think that anybody who was wanting to help out, there would have been a place for them.
Right. Well, I don't know if they looked at me and decided that I was an old man and I was at an increased risk for actually contracting COVID, and that's why they didn't do it. I don't know what went into the decision making, but I know that I wasn't called, so I found another way to be helpful.
Well, and you've definitely put in the time. I mean, for 37 years, you worked and helped people. So, but actually, I've actually heard it from nurses on the young side in their 30s who wanted to go help out, and then they weren't needed. But we'll leave that for another day. One of the things that you talk about in the book, because you've written this fiction book about a woman who dies during a surgery, and then, you know, the medical institution or hospital that this happens in does not want to be completely truthful with this, and the story is about a person probably patterned after yourself who does want to be truthful and explain this, and I think that right now, there have been some things that have happened during COVID that I think, unfortunately, the medical industry will have to answer for in the future. And I think that many doctors feel that they're in a place where they can't say everything that's on their mind.
Correct. A lot of pressure to not fully disclose to patients when things go wrong. And you're right, you summarized the book in a nutshell. It's a story about a woman who goes in for a routine procedure, things go horribly wrong, and then the hospital has to decide whether they are going to live up to their pledge of transparency or whether they're going to slip back into their old ways of finger pointing and hiding the truth. And one person stands up and says that I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And he makes that promise to the family. And he pays a significant personal cost for his efforts. It's truly a novel. It's fiction, loosely based on something that happened. 95% of the characters are completely made up out of whole cloth, but it's a book that I think needs to be read by people who are touched by the healthcare industry, which is essentially all of us, because it has what I believe was an important message to get out.
Dr. Stanley Berry is my guest this hour. We're going to take our quick bottom of the hour news break. This is the program on TNT, and we will be right back.
And now, dude, I have huge news.
I knew it.
TNT Radio News.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. Tornadoes have hit the south of the United States, including Louisiana, parts of Texas and Oklahoma, all the way up to Meridian, Mississippi, towards Alabama as well. Police raids were carried out across Germany against the far-left climate radical group The Last Generation, which is now under investigation for allegedly forming a criminal organization. New Zealand has passed its world-first legislation that bans young people from buying tobacco for life, as it aims to make the country smoke-free by 2025.
Herpes.
Wait, what?
No matter what you do, it's gonna flare up once a year.
From our family to yours.
Happy holidays.
Merry Christmas.
TNT.
Dr. Berry is my guest. He's authored quite a few, or co-authored quite a few numbers of medical publications, and he has this book out right now, which is called A Fight for Full Disclosure. And the reason I wanted to talk to Dr. Berry was to just, you know, put it out there on a bit of a philosophical front. A lot of people will say that when COVID came along, this was something that we were unprepared for, and this stood out as this anomalous event in modern history. And I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but like I've heard what some doctors have said to members of my family, and then I've seen how this has all played out. The rush to, like, the only option that people have is vaccines. Meanwhile, existing drugs like HCQ and ivermectin were denied. So I don't know if you could just give me your thoughts on the current culture of medicine. Do you think we've learned anything from this? And do you think our points of view on all this is going to change?
I do. One of the things that one has to acknowledge is really starting with the George Bush W administration. George Bush, President George Bush, and his administration did a lot for preparedness for a pandemic, and they initiated a lot of pandemic preparation. And then the Obama administration came along, and they probably weren't quite as aggressive, but they certainly shored up what the Bush administration had started. And then the Trump administration came along, and Trump actually was pretty braggadocious about dismantling parts of the CDC, which is the agency in the United States that's responsible for pandemic preparation. Well, now Congress has appropriated money. The knowledge is there that in the U.S. we need to significantly shore up our public health system, and I believe that will be done. But it's probably somewhat of a situation as it is similar to that in war, that we're always fighting the last war. So hopefully when the next pandemic comes along, we'll be ready to adapt and change significantly. You mentioned some of the medicines like Invectin and some of the others. The problem is that and I have a friend who believed in that medication, which, as you know, is a veterinary medicine to rid animals of worms. The problem is that there really was not evidence. And she gave evidence that people on her unit who took it, who got COVID, got over it quickly. Well, the problem is in situations like that, that people, the majority of people who got COVID, got over it quickly. So to take a pill that has nothing to do with getting rid of viruses, and you then get over the virus quickly, which would happen with or without the pill. I mean, there was no rigorous scientific proof.
I'm sorry, I got to stop you there. Ivermectin was a wide spectrum antiviral. It was not just a parasitic drug. I've actually taken it. And so I can't roll with you on that. When I asked my doctor about it 2 years ago, she looked at me like I was some kind of wild-eyed conspiracy theorist. But no, I am just a layman who does research and gets. And I've got to be honest. Now I'm a little razzed up. This is why This is why I'm asking you these questions about the medical profession, because they took these opinions right off the bat that no, we're not going to allow off-label use for these types of drugs. That's just off the table. We're not going to do that. And then they said it was horse paste, which, yes, you can use it in veterinary medicine, but it's not strictly for that. As a matter of fact, the person who discovered it got a Nobel Prize for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that I got you razzed up, because that'll keep us both interested in the conversation.
Okay.
But yeah, but the bottom line is, you know, and I know there were not rigorous studies to prove or disprove its efficacy against COVID, the SARS-CoV-2.
And I would argue the same thing on the vaccines.
Well, but the vaccines were tested in the laboratory, and in fact, they did show efficacy specifically against COVID-2. And the studies that were done on them, exactly, I'll give you that they weren't ideal, but they were studied before they became available to the public. They were studied in populations, both adults and eventually in children. And that's not the case for many of the other medicines. Like the bleach that our past president speculated should be tried on humans to eliminate the virus, and people actually died taking his advice. So medicine is not perfect, and I would not sit here and tell you that the majority of what we do in medicine has been rigorously tested. There was just an article out last month in the British Medical Journal, and it said that only a fraction of what we do in medicine has been rigorously tested. But in the case, I'm sorry, of the Invectin, that didn't have any testing to show in a scientific realm that it had efficacy against SARS-CoV-2.
All right, well, let me ask you this. Well, how do you feel about the what I consider to be a sacred relationship between a doctor and a patient? And because I feel like that has now been overstepped, where now doctors are afraid to say what they think. And if you had been predisposed to want to prescribe that drug, as some doctors have, Pierre Corey being one, and they were not allowed to, and then some doctors would prescribe it, and then the pharmacists would overrule it. Some people went to court asking that hospitals administer this to their ill family members, and those people ended up dying. I guess what I'm trying to say is, look, at the end of the day, if you're my doctor and you and I have this relationship, I'm coming to you because I trust you, not because I'm asking what your peers are telling you to do or what the government. I'm saying, this is my problem. You're my doctor. You and I are the ones trying to figure this out. And I feel like that has been infringed upon.
Well, it's not like most rights in society. It's not a 100% total right. And we have governing bodies, because of the state of medicine in the United States and in the world, back in the before the mid-century, where doctors were early to mid 1900s, that is, where doctors were free to prescribe anything they wanted, whether it worked or not, in the whole patent medicine industry. And people, in some cases, were harmed. So there is no, I don't believe there is an absolute right to almost anything. And I'm speaking for the United States, that is. There's not an absolute right for anything. And thank God for some intervention. And by the way, one of the examples that you gave happened here in Michigan, where a doctor went to court to try to force a hospital to use that medicine, and the court rejected it because, again, there was no scientific evidence that it had efficacy against the virus.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, we'll have to agree to disagree on that, because the Lancet report got pulled after it was put out, and that was what they initially used to push back on all of this. All I'm saying is that we had FDA-approved drugs in the marketplace, and off-label use for illnesses was not something that was unheard of, but then this was villainized from the get-go. And we were all told that, you know, we had to take these draconian measures. So I don't know. I'm just, in your book, Full Disclosure, you're talking about how sometimes the hospital and medical industry is not fully honest about things. And I got to be straight up with you, brother. I don't think that the medical industry has been fully honest with us about COVID.
So two things. And this is just a side story, but I can't help telling it. It's a little off, so, but I'll get back to the question. My publisher wanted to name my book a fight. He wanted to name it Full Disclosure, whereas the title was A Fight for Full Disclosure, because like halfway through writing the book, I found out there was another book called Full Disclosure that had nothing to do with my story. It was about a police investigation, right? So every so often I would go online. I do go online to see what's been written about my book. And I'm so glad that my publisher caved in and let me name the book A Fight for Full Disclosure, because a couple months ago I went on and I found a book called Full Disclosure by Stormy Daniels. And, so at that point I was so happy for my title. For those of you who don't know, Stormy Daniels was the woman who was involved with President Trump. But at any rate, back to your question. Of course, you know, Big Pharma and medicine both entities have been guilty of not being forthright. Although I believe that most physicians and most people who work for pharmaceuticals try to do the right thing. One of the problems gets to be in our country is that medicine is profit driven, and whenever you have you add profit to the mix, you're going to get bad behavior. So I am not an apologist for medical or industry bad behavior. I think most of the people in both sectors are out there trying to do the right thing. But again, mix profit into it, and it is a recipe for problems.
And I am sympathetic to doctors, and I appreciate your forthrightness on this, because I was told by my publicist who I booked you through that you were a really cool guy, and unfortunately we're not talking about funny things, because apparently you have a tremendous sense of humor as well. But what I'm trying to say is, like, I admire you, and I'm sympathetic to doctors, because I think this situation for the parties that you've discussed have put the medical industry in a really bit of a bind.
Right. Well, yes, I mean, it was a really a situation that we hadn't faced since the early 1900s, the influenza epidemic. And the parallels between it, you know, you ask your first question, well, not your first question, but one of your early questions, have we learned anything? Let's hope to God we did, because we did not learn very much from the 1918 through 1920 influenza epidemic. The same fights went on, that people didn't want to wear masks, that people didn't want businesses closed. And as it turned out, the cities that moved rapidly to close businesses and keep them closed for a period of time had half the death rate, literally half the death rate, than cities like Philadelphia, who decided to go on business as usual. So there are, you know, they call it NPI now, non-pharmaceutical interventions, like masks and like avoiding crowded situations when there's an epidemic. We did not learn those lessons very well, and I'm not sure that we learned them very well this time. But hopefully, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, well, right now there is a possibility that we in Los Angeles will go back to masking. I don't know. We have a woman here, Barbara Farrar, who is kind of in charge of our county's health, and she is the one who's figuring out if we're going to do that or not. So right now we're waiting to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've continued to wear a mask when I'm out in public, and I'm going to tell you, I don't like it, but I do think that masking has been shown pretty definitively to decrease the rate of transmission. So I do it. And part of the reason I do it is because, you know, to some extent, I'm a role model. I'm not like Charles Barkley, who says I'm not a role model. And I don't know who's going to see me in public. But I do think that masking is important. And we're undergoing here in Michigan a spike. We were up 30% over a one-week period of time in COVID cases.
Dr. Stan Berry is my guest. We're talking about medicine post-COVID. We're talking about his book, The Fight for full disclosure, and we are going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
With crime out of control in New York City and people afraid to walk the streets or ride the subway, you would hope that when they open the door to their apartment, enter, close the door behind them, they finally feel safe and secure. Well, maybe they do now, but that could change soon. Later this week, the Fair Chance for Housing Act will be getting a public hearing for the first time in the city council. That bill prohibits New York City landlords from performing criminal background checks on prospective tenants, even those convicted of murder and other serious crimes. Reportedly, at least 30 of the council's 51 members have agreed to back this outrageous proposal. Interestingly enough, the bill doesn't affect New York City Housing Authority complexes. Federal law requires them to conduct background checks. But to those affected, you might want to get a head start and put another lock on your door and lock up the kids while you're at it. Word is the mayor, former ex-cop Eric Adams, will sign this trash. New York, New York. It's a hell of a town. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
This is TNT Radio, where you meet the entire menagerie of mankind.
And some who haven't yet been cataloged.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Deprogram on TNT. I am your host, Michael Parker, and I'm speaking with Dr. Stan Berry. And Dr. Berry, let's talk about you for a bit, because when I was reading about you, you're an interesting person. Your dad was a musician, and you wanted to be a writer. And you went to college, and initially, I guess you flunked out, as we sometimes do. And but you became you joined an ambulance service, and was that where you kind of had your epiphany moment that, like, look, I can help people through medicine, and I'm going to do this?
Yeah, it was, and I appreciate you saying flunking out, because that adds to the romantic aspect of the story. I don't all think right. I flunked out of college, but I dropped in and out, that's for sure. But
okay, sorry.
Yeah. No, I like that. You know, I'll okay. take that. But at any rate, I went to college as an English major, and I got really disillusioned with the abstractness of it. So I dropped in and out of school 3 or 4 times. And actually, this is, believe it or not, a true story. I read Ernest Hemingway's novel, A Farewell to Arms, which was a story of an ambulance driver in World War I. And I finished the book, and I picked up the phone and called the county ambulance service and asked them if they had any openings. And they did. And I got a job. And I was floundering because I knew I wanted to be able to do something, you know, something physical, not just writing or whatever, which I wasn't all that good at the time. I hope that's changed, but your listeners will be the judges. But, you know, Mark Twain once said that the two most important days in your life are the day you were born and the day you figured out why. And when I got into the ambulance service, I got trained as an emergency medical technician. Back then, it was only 2 weeks. And then there weren't any real formalized paramedic programs, so the hospital had their own. And I went through 6 months of additional training in order to push drugs and interpret EKGs and all of that. And at the end of it, I thought to myself that if I ever got my you know what together, I could do this, because that was another problem I had. I really lacked discipline. And so after about a year on the ambulance service, I went back to school part-time, working full-time. And I took a year of chemistry in 2 months, which just about killed me. I'm amazed that my roommate still talks to me. I was so evil. And then I took, another science course, but over the prescribed usual period of time, one semester at a time. And then after that, I decided to quit the ambulance service and go back to school full time. And eventually, I didn't get into medical school the first time I applied, but I got in the second time, and I had my foibles. The first year was tough, but I made it through. And after that, it became a more enjoyable ride. It was tough. Doing a residency in obstetrics and gynecology was tough. We were probably working about 110 hours a week or so. We figured we wouldn't even make a minimum wage. And but, you know, you did it because we were all kids in our late 20s and early 30s, and we had that passion. And then for me, the obstetric side was always more fascinating. And so I decided to specialize, which was two more years of training in high risk OB. So that's what I wound up doing. I came to Detroit to do that fellowship, and they didn't find me out along the way. So they gave me a job, and I stayed for 12 more years. So that's how my career began.
Well, I want to express my respect, because when I think about the jobs in life that, I mean, I guess I could do them if I was forced to, but one of the jobs that I wouldn't want to do is be a paramedic. And, you know, I don't even like getting a shot. I don't like getting my blood drawn. And I know I'm not the only person that gets a little queasy about these things. So I have immense respect for first responders and for doctors, surgeons, paramedics, people who can deal with the things that you guys encounter, especially in emergencies.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate
that. I mean that.
Yep. But it has its joys. It has its sorrows. OB is usually a happy specialty, but I, of course, had to pick the end of it where unhappiness is more common than in the in general obstetrics, because I deal with women that have medical problems. And the three main problems that I deal with as a maternal fetal medicine specialist are pregnant women with diabetic disorders, with hypertensive disorders, and pregnant women with preterm labor and trying to prevent preterm birth, which is a huge problem around the world that is so underappreciated. Because when these kids are born extremely premature, they have an increased risk of cerebral palsy, of intellectual deficits, and the cost to society is, you know, billions. And when I say billions, I'm talking, you know, between 25 and 50 billion a year to take care of these poor kids. So, it is gratifying when you can step in and help to try to make a difference.
Well, you just brought up a really interesting and heavy point when you said that, you know, some of these children that are born then become dependent upon the system, and it does cost a lot of money. In Canada right now, that is a big topic, and we've talked about it on the show before, which is medical assistance in dying. And in 2023, they're talking about, because in 2023, in March, if this thing goes through, you will then be allowed medical assistance in dying even if you have a mental illness, which is not an internal physical illness. What do you think of that?
That's out on an ethical limb to me.
Right?
I guess I believe that somebody who is, quote, of right mind, unquote, who really makes the decision that they want to die, and I think there have to be safeguards, like they probably need to have a psychiatric evaluation to make sure that it's not just depression. I do believe that rational people can make that decision. But when you're making a decision over a kid to end the life of a child potentially, or to end the life of somebody who has a mental disorder or an intellectual deficit, that's a bridge too far for me. I haven't time to think about this, but that's crossing a line for me ethically. Well,
I agree with you. And the only reason I brought that up is because in some cases, you know, people that in Canada, and I'm sure it's happened here in the US, although we have very stringent rules towards assistance in dying, but in Canada, you know, some people with serious diseases or illnesses and mounting bills are seeking to take that way out, which I think is just a terrible statement for society in general. It makes me very sad, but that's just what I thought of when you were talking about the unfortunate children that are being preterm.
Right. So,
what causes generally for women to have preterm, what things are happening in the body that make this happen?
The short answer is we don't know the majority of them. In about 10 to 15% of cases, infection of the lower genital tract that probably eventually invades the uterus, the womb, where the fetus is, and then gives rise to preterm labor. But that the infection is probably only a cause in 10 to 15% of cases. Fortunately, some strides have been made in both the prediction, the screening for, and the prediction of premature labor, although none of this stuff is perfect. I work right now until the end of January. I work with the Perinatology Research Branch, which is a satellite of the National Institutes of Health. And in the last 30 years, we've made some big strides, one of which is to screen a mom's cervical length with ultrasound. And below a certain point, we know that she's at increased risk of delivering prematurely. And so we can watch her. We've also finally sorted out the use of cerclage, which in some cases is appropriate. And that is to put a stitch around the cervix, kind of like a purse string in most cases. There are other cerclages to actually tighten the closure of the cervix. And then the other breakthrough has been the use of vaginal progesterone. And that seems to have some real efficacy in preventing premature birth. But we're a long way from getting to the root of it and actually being able to prevent the vast majority of preterm birth.
Progesterone is a female hormone?
Yes, it is. It's a hormone that's normally produced by the placenta, but it can be synthetically produced. And for a while, the thought was that these injections could cause, stop or prevent preterm birth. That's become quite controversial. And actually, the FDA is leaning toward banning that drug because there's the studies that have been done just do not bear out that the drug injectably, and that's a word I just made up, is a failed English major.
That's all right. I got it.
that the injection form of the drug, the research just isn't panning out. And if you're in Los Angeles, the LA Times did a really extensive article about injectable progesterone right around it was either late December or early January. It was a very good article. And just so you know, it made neither doctors nor the pharmaceutical industry look very good. And I have made my residents read that article because it's so instructive about how we get trapped, again, by money and pharmaceutical influence.
Well, let me just ask this really quick question, because this is what you're telling me is fascinating. So was the idea behind the progesterone injections that the placenta did not have enough of the progesterone and that by injecting it in there, that would continue the pregnancy on its correct course?
Very good. I'm smiling because you hit the bullseye. That was certainly part of the theory that in some cases, probably the placenta wasn't producing enough. But in truth, we don't know why it exactly works. And like I said, the injectable form has proven not to work. I don't prescribe it anymore. But the vaginal progesterone, and that is where a woman either inserts a pill or it comes in a cream form and she puts that in every night. That form of the drug seems to have some real efficacy in preventing premature birth, along with serial ultrasounds. And these are intervaginal ultrasounds that actually are the most accurate way of measuring the cervix. And if the cervix is shortening, then interventions can be done. And the goal really, of course, term is 37 weeks, and we'd like to get, you know, kids to at least 39 weeks if we can. But we know that if we can get kids past the 32nd week of completed pregnancy, the risks to those kids of cerebral palsy and intellectual deficits and all of that falls off dramatically after 32 weeks. So I sometimes promise my patients, if you can just get to 32 weeks, I will do the 32-week dance for you.
Right and, on. Well, Dr. Barry, we're coming up towards the end. Tell everybody where they can find A Fight for Full Disclosure. I know it's on all the major platforms, but also your websites and if you're on social media.
Right. I am on social media. My website is stanleymberry.com, no spaces, and it's S-T-A-N-L-E-Y, M like Michael, last name Barry like the fruit, B-E-R-R-Y.com, and there are two buttons there for two of the most popular platforms to buy the book, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. So, yes.
Well, Dr. Barry, thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed it. I like you, and I really appreciate you coming on the show. Happy holidays.
Thank you. And I like to have good discussions with people like you. So I thank you very much for your invitation and for agreeing to interview me.
We will do it again. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Michael Parker, Deprogrammed. We got to take a break. We got another hour coming up. Stick around.